John Quincy Adams declared that the cornerstone of human government was laid upon the first precepts of Christianity. I already talked about John Jay with the Anti-Slavery Society. John Jay left his law practice to serve his country, and he was the first Chief Justice of the United States. Benjamin Rusk ended up becoming the father of public schools and wrote tons of letters on the necessity of having the Bible in public schools. He also started the Philadelphia Humane Society. No, that's not where you take dogs. It's different than that was an anti-slavery society. I go on and on about it. So our founding fathers actually demonstrated their Christian words in their works. John Hancock and John Adams, they were staying overnight at their friend's house. The friend happened to be a preacher, Reverend Jonah Clark, I believe it was. And on the eve of the Revolutionary War, a British major, that was when Parvier was going through, the Redcoats are coming. Then, just before the Revolutionary War began, British Major Pitcairn came in and said, "Disperse ye in the name of George, the sovereign king of England." And these guys said, "We recognize no sovereign but God and no king but Jesus." Do y'all know that the motto of the Revolutionary War was "No king but King Jesus"? Bet you learned that in your schools, didn't you? You didn't? Why not? That was the motto of the Revolutionary War. Come on. No king but King Jesus. You guys all heard that, didn't you? No? That was the motto of the Revolutionary War, and it began right there. I'm going to show you what some of these guys said near their death, because a lot of times you get some quite profound statements here, and people are also always, you know, recording things you say. Listen, Alexander Hamilton: "I have a tender reliance on the mercy of the Almighty through the merits of the Lord Jesus Christ. I am a sinner. I look to Him for mercy. Pray for me." Could anybody write a better testimony of faith to say that you're a Christian than that one? Benjamin Rush, signer of the Declaration of Independence, physician, treasurer of the U.S. Mint, founder of public schools, said, this is a letter to his wife during his final illness, and I don't know why they were separated when he was in his final illness. I'd like to find that out. I don't know that yet. He said, "Blessed Jesus, wash away all my impurities and receive me into thy everlasting kingdom." This is in the testimony of his brothers. Okay, what did others have to say about them? Well, after George Washington died, there was people once again attacking his character. Was he really a Christian? And Nellie Custis Lewis, who was his adopted daughter, said, "All right, we're going to lay this to rest once and for all." She said, "Is it necessary that anyone should ask, did General Washington avow himself to be a believer in Christianity? As well, we may question his patriotism." She's basically saying, look, if you're going to question whether he is a Christian, just question whether the guy was even a patriot. Question his heroic devotion to his country. His mottos were deeds, not words, and for God and my country. His life, his writings prove he was a Christian. See that? His life, his fruit, his works, and his writings. That's his own testimony. So you see all three right here. Her testimony, Nellie Custis Lewis, is saying he's a Christian. She said that his writings, his own words, and his life, his fruit, those are the ways that Jesus told us we can tell if someone was a Christian. John Marshall, he was a Revolutionary general who spent a ton of time with them, said he was a sincere believer in the Christian faith and a truly devout man. Gunning Bedford, who was signer of the Constitution, said, "To the character of hero and patriot, this good man added that of Christian. Although the greatest man upon earth," so basically they're saying right now at this point he was the greatest man on earth, not overall, that would be Jesus, of course. "Although the greatest man upon earth, he disdained not to humble himself before his God and to trust in the mercies of Christ." Look at what some people said about Patrick Henry. "He looked to the restraining and elevating principles of Christianity as the hope of his country's institutions." And so do I. Amen. I'm with you. See, Christianity can have a restraining influence. Who is it? Charles Carroll. No, James McHenry. James McHenry, he's a guy that I call the original Gideon. Gideons are guys, we put Bibles in hotels and motels and just get Bibles out everywhere. James McHenry said, "We increase laws and penal institutions in vain." In other words, we make laws and we build prisons, but it's all in vain because it can't stop crime. I mean, can that stop crime? Have we noticed? Do prisons stop crime? No. Do laws stop crime? No. He said in vain, this is James McHenry, said in vain we increase our laws, we increase our penal institutions, and we try to build entrenchments around people. We try to prevent them from committing crimes. But then James McHenry said, Bibles are strong entrenchments. Bibles are the entrenchment. Bibles are the way that you get prevent people from committing crimes. Where they abound, men cannot pursue wicked courses and at the same time enjoy a quiet conscience. He said, if you want to commit crimes, listen, what we're going to do is we're going to have so many Bibles everywhere that you won't be able to have a quiet conscience. At least your conscience is going to have to be bothering you. And he said that the best way to prevent crimes is to have Bibles and to teach Christianity. And that's what Patrick Henry believed, that Christianity has a restraining influence upon our country. And it has an elevating influence. It elevates our country, elevates the principles of our country. He also said about Patrick Henry, he committed himself in earnest efforts to establish true Christianity in our country. Roger Sherman, he is one of only four guys to sign all four articles that started our country. His epitaph said, he ever adorned the profession of Christianity, which he made in youth and distinguished through life for public usefulness. He made his Christianity useful for his life. By the way, does any of this sound like deism to you? John Adams. John Adams is now looking over the scope of all of our country and all of our founders, and he said, the general principles upon which the fathers achieved independence were the general principles of Christianity. And Patrick Henry, this is a very famous speech that I'm sure you all know about, or at least heard about, is in May 1765, when Patrick Henry was speaking out against the Stamp Act. The Stamp Act was an increased tax that that Britain had in place upon us, and it was really the beginning. You know, Patrick Henry was sort of the voice of the Revolutionary War, right? He really got things going. Then when he finally said, you know, give me liberty or give me death, actually in the middle of that speech, which you never hear that, but he said, forbid it, Almighty God. But he was the voice that got the ball rolling towards us rebelling. I don't like that word, but in a sense rebelling against our tyrants. In his May 1765 speech on the Stamp Act, he said, it cannot be emphasized too clearly and too often that this nation was founded not by religionists, but by Christians. Not on religion, but on the gospel of Jesus Christ. For this very reason, people of other faiths have been afforded asylum, prosperity, and freedom of worship here. How much freedom of worship do you have in Afghanistan? You don't have much, do you? Where the Spirit of the Lord is, there is freedom. The Spirit of the Lord established through our founding fathers this country, and there's freedom. There is freedom to even hate God, hate Christianity, and practice whatever you want, because we're Christians. That's why. Not because we're religionists. See, not by religionists, but by Christians. See, Patrick Henry is saying this about our nation. Well, we finished with talking about our founding fathers and trying to lay the foundation that these guys were Christian men in general. Maybe not every single one of them, and you could pull a couple bones out of the closet of a couple of them. And we're going to start out looking at what were the commands and expectations of our founding fathers. If there were some, what were they? Well, I'm just going to kind of go through four main categories of commands and expectations. Now, these are things that are important for the heritage of our nation. They have many other words of advice, and you may be familiar with Ben Franklin's tons of little quips and bits of advice. We're not talking about that level. We're talking colossal level, something that's important for our nation, for the health and heritage of our nation to pass on. The first one is, we are to carry on the Christian religion as the official religion of America, with no denomination receiving favor from the government. The second one, elect only Christians for our leaders. Now, wouldn't that blow your mind? It doesn't sound like something you hear a lot nowadays, does it? Make worship a part of your public life. Make public service a part of your worship. That doesn't sound like separation of church and state either. And finally, evangelize the nation, and especially the children, in the doctrines of Christianity, in our schools, as the best way to ensure liberty and security for our nation. Laws are not enough. You need Jesus. Let's start with the first one. Christianity, the religion of America. George Washington, you can find this, look this up. If you want to do a Google search and type in George Washington farewell address, you'll find this in paragraph 10, where George Washington is speaking to everyone, the entire American people, and he says, the name of American belongs to you. And with slight shades of difference, you have the same religion. See, we are all Christians that time, or at least we called ourselves Christians, and there were slight shades of differences. There would be Episcopalians, denominationalists, Congregationalists, Baptists, a bunch of them. Slight shades of difference, but all the same religion. In fact, the United States Supreme Court even recognized this fact just years after the Constitution was ratified. in Runkle versus Weinmiller. Now, the reason why this even came up is because at that very moment, the basics were being attacked. See, there's always going to be somebody to attack the basic foundational truths of anything. Always. So even at this time, there are people that are attacking this. And our founder stood up and said, no, hold on a second. Justice Samuel Chase, who signed the Declaration of Independence, he was delegate to the First and Second Continental Congress, and he was right there. And the majority opinion in Runkle versus Weinmiller was, by our form of government, the Christian religion is the established religion. All sects and denominations of Christians are placed on the same and equal footing. That doesn't sound very much like our interpretation nowadays of the First Amendment, which says that there will be no establishment of religion. You know the Establishment Clause? We're going to get to that in a little bit. The key is established religion. Congress shall make no law respecting an establishment of religion. And the key is in that word religion. What did they mean by that? But here you can see, if they meant what we think it means, there's a problem here, because in this case, they said the Christian religion is the established religion. Justice Joseph Story, who was appointed by James Madison, said, at the time of the adoption of the Constitution and of the amendment to it, now under consideration, that's the First Amendment, the one that has the freedom of religion in it. He says, the general, if not the universal sentiment in America, he said, in America, we're talking beyond even founding fathers, in all of America, was that Christianity ought to receive encouragement from the state. Wait a second, Joseph Story. I know you're writing a commentary on the Constitution of the United States. I know that James Madison, the father of the Constitution, you know, appointed you. But I don't think you know what's going on here, pal, because we don't establish religion here and we don't encourage any particular religion. See, that's what we say today. In fact, in 1800, when Washington, D.C. became the national capital and the president moved in the White House and Congress moved in the Capitol, the first thing Congress did was to approve the use of the Capitol building as a church building for Christian worship services. 67 years later, it's the largest Protestant church in America. In fact, they not only use a Capitol building, they use a war building and the Treasury building and one other that I can't think of. And these services went on for 4 hours in the morning. And then they had an evening service. And John Quincy Adams has his diary, and he regularly writes about what happened in these church services. 4 hours long, totally silent, sitting on hardwood benches, nobody sleeping. Amazing. Not even what you get nowadays, 4 hours. We get bored if we get, 40 minutes of a sermon. We're ready to go home. These guys sat there for 4 hours, and we're saying that they're not Christians, and saying that Christianity was not the religion of America. Our founders knew what we should know now, and that is the future of a nation is never secure if you ignore Jesus. Never. The future of a nation is not secure at all if they have forsaken Jesus. And our founders knew that, which is why they said, you need to carry on the Christian religion as the official religion of America, with no denomination receiving favor from it. One thing that I'm afraid that may happen, it hasn't happened but could, is that we would someday become a technically secular nation, where we would try to remove all talk about God in our Declaration of Independence, of which he's mentioned 4 times, or anything like this. We try to erase history completely and have no concern with following after what our Constitution is built upon. Because Alexander Hamilton said that our Constitution was based upon Christianity, upon Jesus. And he established a Christian Constitutional Society. Remember we talked about that? And he went around the world trying to establish Christian constitutional democracies, or republics, you'd say, across the globe. Well, listen to this. Turkey is officially a secular state now, even though it has Muslim origins. Spain is now officially a secular state, despite their Catholic origins. Italy, officially a secular state. They removed all religious designations from their post-war constitution in 1945. France, secular nation since the revolution. Greece, still officially an Orthodox country, but under pressure from the European Union, they recently removed from their bearer of their seal all religious affiliations on their Greek passports. It's just one right after another, after another, after another nation doing this. Are we going to get under the same pressure and do that? That's why our founder said, Christianity is a religion of America, and we've got to continue it on. We're not going to last if we forsake that. The next thing, before I go on that, one more thing. It seems like everybody else seems to know this fact that I just said here, that Christianity is a religion of America. Do you think that Saddam or anybody in the Middle East doubts that we're a Christian nation? Is there really any doubt? Do they think that they're just up against a secular nation? Totally secular. Absolutely no Christian root or background. No. Listen to what Charles Habib Malik said. He is a UN Security Council member, an ambassador from Lebanon. In 1958, he said this. The good in the United States would never have come into being without the blessing and power of Jesus Christ. Whoever tries to conceive the American word without taking into full account of the suffering and love and salvation of Christ is only dreaming. I know how embarrassing this matter is to politicians, bureaucrats, businessmen, and cynics, but whatever these honored men think, the irrefutable truth is that the soul of America is at its best and highest Christian. Now, it takes a Lebanese man to say this, because we don't have the guts to say it anymore. Nobody in our government wants to say that anymore. The public opinion is fading away. No, we're not a Christian nation. You know, we're the old melting pot. All religions, we're just sort of the one religion fits all kind of thing. No. We are a melting pot of culture, not of religion. Our founders intended that we would carry on the Christian religion as the official religion of America. And it's been so clear throughout history that everybody else can see it, but we've been blinded. We can't see it anymore. It's like we don't want it that way anymore. We really don't want it to be a Christian nation. The other thing you'll notice is if our religion, if the religion of America was not Christianity, explain this fact. Why is it that every single president has at least claimed to be a Christian? Now, a politician would not claim to be something if he didn't think it was in his benefit. Now, you and I know that not every single one of them were born-again Christians and are saying they're a Christian just because it's the truth and they can't deny Christ. Some of them, like a recent president that we had, also claimed to be a Christian, but he was certainly very far from that. So why would somebody claim to be something? There are two reasons. They really, 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 really think they are, or they are, okay? But there's one other thing. Why would they promote it? Why would a presidential candidate promote it? Why would Gore want to be seen going into church on Sundays? Why would he make sure that they, remember when they were running between Bush and Gore? He made sure that on Sundays that they saw him going into church. Why would that happen? Why would a presidential candidate intentionally want people to see and know that they were affiliated with Christianity? If it wasn't for the fact that Christianity has been the religion of America. It's just accepted. It's sort of expected that if you're going to be the president, you're going to go to church. The next thing, command of our founding fathers, we are to elect only Christians for our leaders. Elias Boutineau, he was one of the presidents of America before George Washington. He's called President of the Continental Congress. He was director of the United States Mint. Look at that. He was also a founder of the American Bible Society. And he's not the only one that was involved in Bible societies and mass distribution of Bibles of our founders. But he said, we should be religiously careful in our choice of all public officers and judge of the tree by its fruit. Don't just go by what they say. They can say they're a Christian all they want, but you judge the tree by its fruits, just like the Bible says. I love this one. I remember when I found this, I came running into the other room. Misha, you've got to hear this. I mean, everything is so clear. When you listen to what Samuel Johnson, he was responsible for ratifying the Constitution, very involved in the convention, governor of North Carolina. He said, it is apprehended. In other words, the question has come up. Is it possible, could it possibly ever happen that Jews, Mahometans, that was the word they used that time for Muslim, pagans, etc., may be elected to high offices under the government of the United States. Okay, here's what was going on. There was a big debate going on the floor. We know that we've got to have Christians that are leaders. See, I'm saying all this. Now, they're thinking that, and they're thinking, okay, for the future, how are we going to make sure that happens? Could anybody else be elected? Could we ever have the future of our nation Well, you wouldn't have a Christian in high offices? Well, Samuel John said, hold on a second, guys, hold on. The question has come up, could we ever have Jews or Muslims or pagans elected in the high offices? Look, those who are Muslims or any others who are not professors of the Christian religion can never be elected to the office of president or other high office unless, first, the people of America lay aside the Christian religion altogether. Then it may happen. Should this unfortunately take place, the people will choose such men as think as they do themselves. But the only way we're ever going to get, Samuel John's talking, the only way you're ever going to get somebody that's not a Christian in the office is if the people just say, all right, let's just tube Christianity altogether. Let's just forget the whole thing. And then they'll just start picking people that think whatever they think at the time. Isn't that powerful? I mean, that's almost what's happening now. Almost it is what's happening now. Because people aren't judging the tree by its fruit. Noah Webster said about electing only Christians, let it be impressed on your mind that God commands you to choose for rulers just men who will rule in the fear of God. Then he quoted the Bible. If the citizens neglect their duty and place unprincipled men in office, the government will soon be corrupted. Oh, wow, you think that could happen? If our government fails to secure public prosperity and happiness, it must be because the citizens neglect the divine commands and elect bad men to make and administer the laws. I think that says it all, doesn't it? John Jay, he was first Chief Justice, said, Providence has given to our people the choice of their rulers, and it is the duty as well as the privilege and interest of our Christian nation, uh-oh, there it is again, Christian nation, to select and prefer Christians for their rulers. This one, if this doesn't lay it out flat on its back, I don't know what will. This is Article 22 of the Constitution of Delaware in 1776. You can look this up just by typing in that right there. Constitution of Delaware, 1776. Required all officers, besides taking an oath of allegiance to the state, to make and subscribe to the following declaration. I, Tom Eads, do profess faith in God the Father, and in Jesus Christ, his only Son, and in the Holy Ghost, one God, blessed forevermore. And I do acknowledge the Holy Scriptures of the Old and New Testament to be given by divine inspiration. Does that nail it or what? Were our founders Christian? Did they expect that the people serving in governmental offices be Christian? They're trying to weed out people that even have inerrant doctrine. Our third command of our founding fathers, make worship a part of your public life. And then make public service a part of your worship. See, they made worship a part of their public life. They had prayer and chaplains in Congress. I told you last time about how Benjamin Franklin called for prayer at the first meeting of Congress, at the Constitutional Convention in 1787, and that has just continued on till this day. And chaplains. On the first day of May in 1789, Washington gave his first speech, and then after he was done, the first order of business after Washington's first speech, right after he became president, was this. Okay, all right, guys, I give my speech. Okay, we're going to do something. We're going to get this nation going. What are we going to do first? Well, we got to elect a chaplain. That was the first thing they did, the very first thing they did. And they paid him. And there were six guys that were on the committee for picking the guy. His name was Dr. Lynn. He was chaplain. And three of those guys were writers of the Constitution, Madison, Ellsworth, and Sherman. Okay. You know, the question nowadays has already come up, if you aren't aware about this, is should chaplains be paid? Because that's sort of putting religion into government, right? We're supposed to separate those two. Well, let's see what's constitutional. Wouldn't Madison, the father of the Constitution, how about Sherman, one of only four guys that signed, one of only six guys, I'm sorry, to sign all four articles that began our nation? Wouldn't he know? Wouldn't Ellsworth know? Those were the three guys that elected a chaplain and paid him. I already told you about how they used the Capitol building, the treasury, and the war offices for Sunday Christian services. This is about making public service a part of your worship. See, we are separating as Christians. I think a lot of us are separating. Okay, you got the government kind of doing its thing over here, and then you got your church, and you got your religious life over here. And they're sort of not really together. John Peter Gabriel Muhlenberg was one of the most prolific, I think he reached major, if I remember right, in the Revolutionary War. But he didn't start out that way. He started out as a minister. I believe he's a Lutheran minister. And this is just as the Revolutionary War was getting started. And he gave a sermon on Ecclesiastes chapter 3. And when he got to the last verse where it says there's a time for peace and a time for war, he said, men and women, surely this is not a time for peace. This is a time for war. And he took off his clerical robe. And this is a statue you can find in the U.S. Capitol Hall of Statues honoring him, because he was one of our great founding fathers. This is his clerical robe right here, and underneath it, see, he's got the garb that you'd wear if you were in the Continental Army. He took that off. He said, all right, let's go. And 300 men followed him, and they formed, I think it was the 8th Virginia Brigade. They went out and were one of the most prolific of all the brigades out there, being present at all the major battles. Last command, evangelize the nation, especially the children. See, this is the best way. You're going to try tons of other ways to try to make our nation prosperous and secure. This is our founding fathers basically saying this. But it ain't going to happen if the next generation aren't Christians. If they're not Christians, all those bad things that we've been talking about are going to happen if your children and the next generation aren't Christians. So number one, numero uno, you're going to have to evangelize the children. Benjamin Franklin, in 1749, his plan of education for public schools in Pennsylvania, he insisted that schools teach the excellency of the Christian religion above all others, ancient or modern. George Washington said, what students would learn in American schools above all is the religion of Christ. That's number one. Before you learn anything, before you learn your ABCs or your 1, 2, 3s, you're going to learn about Jesus, kids. Samuel Adams, he was the principal organizer of the Boston Tea Party, signed the Declaration of Independence. He said, let divines and philosophers, statesmen and patriots, in other words, just everybody, let them unite their endeavors to renovate the age by impressing the minds of men with the importance of educating their little boys and girls, inculcating, infusing in the minds of youth the fear and love of the deity, and leading them in the study and practice of the exalted virtues of the Christian system. You've got to make sure that everybody gets this one fact straight. Everybody. We've got to infuse our children with Christianity. Noah Webster said, this is in the front of this right here. This is the 1828 dictionary. You can get a copy of this. I can tell you how you can order if you want right here. The preface to this has a ton of good material about the Christian heritage of our nation. He said in the preface to his dictionary, in my view, the Christian religion is the most important and one of the first things in which all children under a free government ought to be instructed. Benjamin Rush, who was the father of public schools, said, I lament that we waste so much time and money in punishing crimes and take so little pains to prevent them. We neglect the only means of establishing and perpetuating our republican form of government, that is, the universal education of our youth in the principles of Christianity by means of the Bible. So, you can try to punish crime all day long if you want, and you are wasting your time, says Benjamin Rush. Physician, youngest signer of the Declaration of Independence, father of public schools. The only way you're going to do it is to get the Bible in the schools and teach your children. Otherwise, you're going to have so many people in the prisons, they're going to be stuffed full. Isn't that what happened? By withholding the knowledge of the scriptures from children, we deprive ourselves of the best means of awakening moral sensibility in their minds. The best way that you can teach children right from wrong is the Bible, he said.